Whoa, that sound good. I may have to adjust the volume. How's that? Yeah, that's probably a little bit better. Okay, good afternoon. Today, as the slide shows, I want to start a new topic, which is scanning. And apropos to that, I have the next project, which is the scanner that you'll be doing for your compiler. And there's also a homework, which has the good property. It's only one question, but it's one of those questions that can be a little tricky, as you'll see. Maybe you've read it already, maybe not. So let me start around first is the programming assignment, the scanner. And interestingly enough, this thing is only 5 pages long. So sometimes it's the case that a conceptually harder problem turns out to be simpler. And one of the reasons for that is I'll be getting into is that we're going to be actually using a tool that actually generates programs rather than having to write them by hand. I think I said last time, but this is always an issue of situation there that... When people think about using programs, it's almost always the case that the, let me get this adjusted. It's almost always the case that users of programs think in terms of programming as what? That's when I get it down there. And that makes a lot of sense. And the example I used last time was if you happen to have a nav system either built into your car or there's plenty of them that are just on smartphones, what you do is you simply say what it is I want. Of course, in the context of the program, it's a route from one point A to point B. So you say, give me a route from the Epic campus down to O'Hare, for example. And as you might imagine, the computer is going to be doing all sorts of checking to find out what the best route is. And there are certain parameters you can set. Some people, for example, like to be on expressways because they tend to be fast. Others, like my brother, hates to be on expressways. He's one of these guys that thinks everybody going over 50 miles per hour is his enemy and is out to get him. So he's one of these folks that if you could get by with 25 miles per hour on an expressway, you would. So what he would do is he'd say, stay off the expressways and take the back routes, which are much slower, of course, but also less exciting by his measure. It's also the case that the programs now are smart enough that they know about road construction. They know about traffic delays. They may know about accidents that have occurred and all these sort of things that would change how you're going to go about doing the route. On the other hand, one of the sad things when you first learn programming is you learn the level of detail that was necessary. And what you were doing as a programmer is doing the how. And at the lowest level, how is absolutely important. The nav system guidance is done by programmers who are not only worried about what people want, but how they're going to realize it. How do you figure out what the best route is? It's one of those situations where I think computer science education helps in that context, if only because you learn one of the first rules is break up a problem into many solvable pieces, and each piece then is put together to do a whole solution. So I guess if we were doing from here to O'Hare, the first thing you would say is, how do we get from Verona or perhaps Madison to Chicago or Chicago suburbs? Is O'Hare in Chicago proper or is it one of the suburbs? No Chicagoites here. It's a suburb, is it? Yeah, okay. So you might need to know the right county or something like that. So it would figure out that one out. And then a subproblem is, well, how do we get from Verona to the entrance to the expressway? And similarly, what exit do I take off the interstate or the Illinois tollway to get me to O'Hare? And fortunately, I guess we're not too far from the expressway here, certainly not from Verona Road. And it's the case, I guess, one of the expressways then goes right past O'Hare. You can certainly see the big bodies coming in and all that. So what we're going to be learning today is that we are able to simplify our task of building a compiler by transferring what we're used to doing, namely a how, into a much higher level command that's a what. Now, even Watts, in this context, have to be very precise. So I can get away with saying, show me a route here. Well, where's here? I'm in Verona, but Verona is, I won't say a big city, but it's something where it's got some parameters. So do these buildings have street addresses if I want to mail something, or do I just send it to Epic Proper and the mailroom takes care of it? Right, so if it needed to know a real address, I'd be in trouble. And similarly, I'm not sure probably if O'Hare is an address, it's an address of the business office way, way, way from the drop-off places where you put in your luggage and go to the gates. So in this particular case, we're going to learn that our goal in programming in many cases is translate from a how to a what. The advantage of what's when you can do it is that they're in very limited domains. So, for example, nav systems say, tell me how to get from here to O'Hare, but it's not going to tell me, for example, which is the best airline to take or to avoid. All airlines have good points and bad points and something like that. So the domain has to be very fixed. In the case of our scanner, we're going to say exactly what it is we want the scanner to do. It'll do that, but anything much beyond it is not going to work cleanly or may not work at all. And in fact, that'll be a build-in a little later today or maybe next lecture on why everything isn't done in the scanner. Remember the terminology, there was something called a scanner that just identifies individual little words, things like an identifier or an integer or an operator or perhaps a quoted string for something that's more complex or something like a comment. In fact, let me start these things around. I'm talking about doing it and I didn't do it. Here they are. So let's do that. So I got to be careful not to kill myself on that. I'll hide it on them. So one of the things I'll call your attention to is when you get this, you might want to take a quick peek at pages 2 and 3, because that's really going to be the what that you're specifying. There's going to be, I, as a language designer, said, this language shall have this and this and this and that. And this, in a fairly precise form, which we'll develop today, says exactly what it is I mean. In some cases, it's pretty straightforward. A plus sign is a plus sign, big deal. But other things like identifiers can be a tad more complex. Why? Well, not everything that looks like an identifier is an identifier. There are things called reserve words, things like if and while and go to, if you happen to use that, and break and continue. And in our ultimate wisdom, there's a rule that says if you want to have an identifier that's equal to that name, you may not. It's predetermined that these have magic meaning. And I'll explain to you why. We could do it the other way around. Other languages did it in the old days. But in some cases, it's a matter of experience. And almost all languages now have reserved words. Now, no, I haven't used cache much, just glance at it. Does cache have reserved words where certain things cannot be an identifier? They have to be some pre-attributed meaning? Yeah, I would think so. It's almost universal now. But it didn't have to be, and we'll show you some of the pluses and the minuses of that. So let me start these around, and there should be enough, but if there isn't any in a particular column here, just wait until you reach the back and there should be some extras turning up. And here's the second assignment, and this is a rather simpler one because it's just one question. And it's a question that's very relevant to what I'm talking about because it's talking about how we define a comment. And a comment as you're accustomed to it in C, C++, and Java. But interestingly, not in CSX. Partially, that's just to set up this question. But it shows that sometimes the obvious solution to a problem isn't workable. And sometimes you have to be a tad clever, even if all you're doing is specifying what. It's one of these situations where there's an old saying, be careful what you ask for, because you just may get it. Well, in this particular question toward the bottom, we have 6 different possible definitions of a comment. Some of them probably are right. For sure, some of them are wrong. And in some cases, it's easy to see if something's wrong. It's not always easy to see if there's a subtle error on something that looks right but isn't quite. And that's, I wouldn't say the drawback, but it's the responsibility. It's almost as if you were king or dictator or something. You say, this is the way it's going to be. But if you're making the rules, you ought to think them through, or otherwise it may be you cause more harm than good. So let me start these around. This is just one page, so, and most of the back page is blank, so this is not as bad as it could be. And if you've already printed these out, you can let it go by. And if you don't work from printed stuff, you might pass it by too. But from years and years of experience, I always like to put something in your hand, if only so that somebody says, what, there was a project too? And I said, yeah, I handed you a piece of paper and it was right on there. So in some way, it's just a matter of making sure that you're fully aware of what's happening in terms of scheduling. This thing is unfortunate too in that all the other assignments but this one have 3 weeks. This thing ends up having effectively 2 weeks. Reason for that is the university in its infinite wisdom has only given me 14 weeks this semester. Historically, typically, I got 15 weeks and then 5 projects, 3 weeks a pop. But in this case, the situation was there was Labor Day, and there's actually a state rule, you may or may not believe that classes in no UW system may start until after Labor Day. Now, why is that? What's magic about Labor Day as far as the UW system's concerned? It's the fact that, particularly among undergraduates, a lot of them work at the various attractions, things like the Dells or any of the other things. And, of course, the big end of summer day is Labor Day. So the last day to take the whole family out and have some fun. So we have to have the labor force available that day. But then after Labor Day, summer activities start to tone down, and as a result, the people who are employed are released and they come back, and many of them are working their way through school. So that being the case, you can never have class start on Labor Day. In the past, they sometimes started the day after, but this year they didn't. They started on Wednesday. And again, it's just written in the rule. Some wise person or group of people knew it. But since our lecture is on Tuesday, we effectively lost that first week in terms of doing it. So that's the history of that. But it turns out that I think once you get the hang of using a scanner generator, this is one of the easier problems. Easier in some sense because I've given you the answers. All you have to do is figure out how to paraphrase them into the language that the actual generator expects. So let me go back to our screen. And let me sort of make the case why we want the tool to begin with, because at first cut, scanning seems to be remarkably easy. It's something that you could perhaps do as one of your first programming projects. And for simple languages, that's true. For more complex, it's also true. There also turns out to be a secondary reason that's even more compelling. So it's a system where you simply read character by character. So what your scanner does is open a text file, essentially. They call it a stream, but it's essentially a sequence of individual characters, A, B, C, digits, and all the various ASCII characters. It turns out, by the way, that one of the nice things about these tools is, although we're going to be using them with ASCII, it's a situation there where Java has an expanded character set called Unicode, and Unicode doesn't take a single byte, it takes 2 bytes. No, you didn't take my class the last time, so you wouldn't know this. So the 2 bytes are rich enough that you can have not just the Roman alphabet, but you can have almost every other alphabet that actually has an alphabet. So there's Greek and Cyrillic and Arabic and Hebrew and I think Hindu, or one of the main Asian Indian languages. There's a linearized version of Japanese, I think a linearized version of Korean. Now, anybody Chinese, is there a linearized Chinese that fits in bytecodes so that you can do that? Remember, Chinese is a little different because it doesn't have an alphabet to say. It has all these special symbolic characters, and they're not necessarily combined one from the other, so I'm not sure what they do. But the point of this is then that once you know the technology, if, for example, you were hired to do a programming language in French, they decided to call you to Paris, and you know, you be very regretful about doing it, but you'll do it for the good of the company. And, you know, I'll live in Paris for a month or two or a year or two or a decade or two. And the French are very careful about having their own language preserved. So it's the case that sometimes you'll see a program that's written in C or Java or something else, but all the identifiers and even the reserved words are in French. Because there's no reason why they can't be. Just take whatever it is and all the words have a cognate and away you go. So being able to change languages, which is something you might need to do for programming language or even for sort of an interactive language where you have an application that interacts and there are certain commands you can give it that are meant to look more like English than mathematics. That's an important thing in many apps, is that you don't want to scare away your clientele. And many people who are using computers have sort of a math phobia. That is, you have anything that looks like real mathematics, anything be of integers and plus and minus. Oh my God, that's math. I can't do math. Math is real hard. I'm not smart enough for that. And it turns out you probably don't need math at all. Maybe underneath it's there, but not totally. So at the very beginning, all that would happen is you'd read characters. Is that an A? Oh, I bet you you're an identifier. Except maybe you're the beginning of a reserved word. If I see a plus, oh, you're probably a plus sign. Except for the fact that if you remember floating point numbers can be written in a form that has an exponent. And an exponent can be a positive exponent or a negative exponent. So you can actually have a plus sign inside of a number. If you see a dot very well might be the case that it represents a qualifier between a class name and an identifier. So class dot field, for example. But maybe not. Because dots also, of course, appear in fractional numbers, like 1.2 or something with the dot in between there. So as the languages get more and more complex, looking at characters is conceivable, but it gets more and more complex because there's more possibilities. Even more compelling than that is the fact that many languages are designed and evolve incrementally. So it'd be the case that you have a scanner working beautifully and the word comes from above, you're going to change it in this way or that. It might be a simple change or not. If you've written a scanner by hand, you got to go through the whole scanner and say, okay, now we have this new component. What am I going to do with it? Is this part disturbed? Is that part or is the other? If you, however, have a tool like ours, if you look at pages 2 and 3, there'd be another line that says, oh, yeah, here's a new command. It's a Weibelfitzer command, and it has this form. And you simply spell out this form. And the cool part is it'd be up to the scanner generator to be able to differentiate, is this character part of a string? Is it part of a character? Is it part of a comment? Or is it part of a Weibelfitzer? And its job is to figure it out. And in fact, if there's an ambiguity, we'll even be able to figure out, give rules about how the ambiguity is resolved. So sometimes a great example is that typically a reserved word, like if, looks exactly like an identifier. But there's a rule that says, oh no, reserved words take priority. So if I see an IF, I can set things up so that it says, that's a reserved word. But again, it's smart enough to know if I type IF, reserved word, but if I type IFF, that's not a reserved word anymore. It turns out that that's an identifier. So just because you happen to have a simple reserved word like if, you don't have to worry about the fact that an identifier that begins with IF or has IF embedded within it is going to be misconstrued. So the system is able to handle problems we'd have to worry about in a very standard way. Now, it might be that the ambiguity between this and that is significant enough that you change to def. But it'll tell you, yes, I can handle it, and I'll have a specific rule that says, in the case of overlap, here's what I do. And it turns out there's only two rules, and they're very intuitive and very easy for you to understand. So we're going to have a sequence of characters, and deep down underneath, there is going to be a loop that says, here's a character, what do I do with it? Here's another character, what do I do with it? But you're not going to have a series of huge number of ifs. Maybe a tree says, if it's an A, is the next letter a B? If it's a B, is the next letter a C? And so on. Rather, there'd be some tables that you won't bother to see that'd be automatically generated that would say, okay, read the characters, and it'll guide through some logic diagram that finally says, okay, here's the end. I know for sure this is an identifier. And it began with A, and it ended in F, and it was this many characters long. And feed that information back to you for use in the rest of the compiler. So it gets rid of a lot of tedium, and it makes revising programs, scanner components, much easier than it otherwise would be. So we're going to call it a scanner, but historically there are other names too. Lexical analyzer or lexer is a term you might sometimes see. If so, it's just a matter of having different terms for the same thing. This is what I was alluding to a bit ago, namely, we're going to use a formal notation, something that looks like a form of mathematics, but not mathematics for numbers, but mathematics for strings. And as I mentioned last time, it's kind of odd that almost all of us have seen some element of advanced mathematics, way beyond what we'll ever use. I remember back in college, I learned about integrals. But I must admit, the day I left college, I hadn't written an integral in all those years, and it's been more years than I care to admit. On the other hand, I use strings all the time, in terms of writing, in terms of programs, in terms of communication. And yet something like the example I gave last time, a formal definition that said, I wanted a five-letter word that began with this letter, ended in that letter, and had a total of five letters, hence three in between. That's an easy thing to say, but it's not a formal notation, whereas in this case it could be, and we'll see an example where we're going to use a scanner not for a programming language, but rather for a program that helps you out in doing crossword puzzles. And again, if you're deeply into crossword puzzles, I'm sure there's some great apps out there. So this is sort of a homebrew one. It says, my gosh, I know there's a word there and I can't find it. Fortunately, well, not even necessarily fortunately, if you know the first letter, you're not too bad off. But if you know the second letter, you're in deep trouble. Unless, again, you know, you are willing to kind of reorder the listing of words in a dictionary. So tools like this really are conceivable as something that could be really useful. So the regular expression formalism is to say precisely what it is I want. In many cases, it won't necessarily be a single word. It might be a series of possibilities. And that's, of course, always the problem in doing crosswords. There's a number of possibilities. Is it this one or that one? And you have to look at the clue or look at other words that kind of cross vertically or horizontally to give you some info about which one might be the better choice. And again, when I said, well, why bother? Are tokens very simple? And as I alluded to, they're not always. One of the more complex structures, as you'll see, if only by looking at the definition about how complex it is what's allowed in a quoted string. That is, typically our languages use double quotes for strings. Historically, a few languages use single quotes, but it turns out that in this case, it doesn't matter. In fact, some languages even allow triple quotes for whatever reason, and you can imagine that too. Well, it turns out that there are all sorts of questions once a string was developed. It starts with a double quote and ends with a double quote. But can I have a double quote in the middle as part of the body of the string? There are cases where you might, and there's some way of saying this double quote is not meant to terminate. This is meant to be part of the text that the double quote has. Another question is, what about unprintables? We won't consider blank unprintable, even though it's hard to see, but there are other things like a new line, a tab. There's actually maybe 10 or 15 of them. There's one that people hardly ever use, but I think still works, namely, there was a bell character. And what would happen is when you print the bell character, a little ding, 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 ding inside the printer would go off. And one of the tricks people would use for that is what programs in the old days were so slow, they would take not seconds, but maybe minutes or tens of minutes. So what you would do is at the end of the program, you'd write a little command, program done, ding, 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 and then just kind of slide back, you know, you didn't have your smartphone then, but, you know, you maybe had a magazine or slide back and close your eyes for a bit, and when ding, ding, ding came, you would be knowing that your program had printed out the sound of a bell by actually toning it out. So that character still exists. I don't know if it's fully implemented, but not. So those sort of issues. Here's a case about embedded characters. What about zero-length strings? It turns out that it's almost like the number zero. In the old days, way old days, people argued, well, zero wasn't really a number because it's nothing. But it turns out, of course, that it makes a lot of sense to have zero because there are lots of things. You got plenty of nothing. That's one of them. So, you know, going through your inventory, you know, how many shirts do I have? How many pairs of socks do I have? How many shoes do I have? How many gold bars do I have? And sometimes you have to fill in zero just to be honest about it. But historically, some languages did a very silly thing. That is, they let the structure of a common utilized token, like a quoted string, be interfered with by how it was implemented. And it turns out there was at least one language that I actually had to implement that disallowed zero-length strings, not for a good reason, but simply because zero-length strings were simply arrays of characters, and you weren't allowed to have zero-length arrays. That's going to be something else we'll have to get to later. When you create an array in a language, should you be allowed to have a zero-length array? In a lot of cases, people say, no, that's a waste. If there's no character, if there's nothing in the array, why would you ever want to index into it? But it turns out people making that argument lost track of the bigger picture. In the old days, array length was written into the language at programming time. So you'd say this string is going to be 10 characters long or 12 characters long. And that, of course, turned out to be a terrible definition, and it still kind of haunts us. So it turns out my login, not it's computer science, but on campus, is CNFISCHE, but no R. And I always have to remember it by the exception. Now, why was that? Well, you saw me counting off. It was 5 + 3 = 8. And in the old days, many computers had the maximum length of an identifier or a string like somebody's name was 8 characters. And if it was longer than that, it got El Chapo'd. They may still do that to some extent. If you're somebody that has the fortune or misfortune of having a last name that's 25 characters, there certainly are programs that take it, but I imagine there may be others that at some point say enough is enough. And what they do is they take it all, but they say only the first however many are relevant. So those sorts of issues still plague us a little bit. But now the rule is we try to get away from the notion of implementation controlling the flexibility of a user. And yes. Well, is this in terms of the symbol table or the scanner? Oh, yeah, reasonably so. HTML is just a programming language. And I kind of hate to admit it, but I'm one of the people who still programs in raw HTML. And there are preprocessors that can go to HTML and convert it partially or fully into what you would see on a screen. So, yeah, absolutely, it's a situation there where I think it's the case that you may have seen something like XML, and there are things XML is a tree-based language, HTML is hypertext markup language, but XML is a tree-oriented family of languages, and many, many things are transformed from text form to tree form. And I think HTML, when it's processed, is doing that. For sure, when you have the renderer going on there and figuring out how to place things and all that, it doesn't see those darn pointy brackets and the backslash and all that. Those are simply delimiters, and I hadn't thought about it in that context, but yes, HTML and a preprocessor that would do some simple processing of HTML, maybe for checking for errors or just going down to a form that's more readily manipulable, is something that would make a lot of sense. So what we're going to then do, so we're going to have precise definition of tokens, and that's, again, what's on that handout sheet. We're giving you rules in terms of the regular expression notation, and it's actually a notation written in the form that JLEX, which is the tool we use, recognizes. Let me warn you in advance that, just like mathematics versus computing, there's two related but slightly different notions. So it's in the case, remember, I was talking about mathematical notation. And if, for example, you're writing down an equation in mathematics, you can do things like superscripts and subscripts. There are all kinds of special symbols like what do they call that thing that does the square root of the radical, I think it is. You know, funny sort of thing, I can draw it out, but I can't say it. And lots of other things. So those things exist in mathematics, and they're carried across into programming, like in terms of C or Fortran or Java. But they get changed a little bit. Like, for example, subscripts become indices inside of square brackets. The exponentiation oftentimes, if it exists, has a special operator that says, I'm not multiplication, I'm division, I'm to the power of. And that's sometimes a double star and sometimes a caret symbol. So Just as that's the case, we're going to develop a notation that kind of looks like mathematics, but we're going to have to write it in form that can be programmed, that is typed in and handled by an ordinary text editor. So what happens is we'll develop regular expression notation, and then we'll take the formulation that JLEX requires as we actually program it and get the scanner to be generated from the DEF. But the two notions will be exactly identical, just they're written down in a little bit different form. The regular expressions was developed by mathematicians who knew all these cool mathematical notations. When it got around to poor old programmers, we were stuck with the fact that we had ASCII characters and essentially a linearized sequence. In most cases, when you're typing, you still don't have superscript or subscript unless you're in something like Word or something, which allows you to munch around with fonts. So the way you get superscripts and subscripts in a lot of word processing languages is you simply change the font to something that falls down into a small form or jumps up into a form. But internally, it's really just a sequence of symbols which have some formatting notation associated with them, which makes them look kind of like they're two-dimensional when they really aren't. So let's talk about regular expressions. This is the notation, again, that's written on pages 2 and 3. And what they're going to do is give patterns. And they're going to pattern that says, here is a series of strings that are constrained to match this pattern. In some cases, the patterns are immensely trivial. So let me just hop over to my... So in some cases, we'll get a clean one here. It'd be the case that if I want to write down the definition of a string, I can write down A, B, C. And what happens is that's a series of individual characters that represent themselves, and they're formed into a string. However, there exist other things like an OR symbol, which is the OR bar. And the OR bar, just like in mathematics, says A or B. So we're not doing Booleans in this case, so we're doing strings. So it says it can be ABC or NBC. And I guess, of course, you know, I guess they have to put in their PBS, right? So, and so on and so forth. That used to be pretty easy, but now depending on how many cable channels you have, you know, there's probably more channels than I can fit on this page of paper. But this is a simple form. But just like mathematics can be simple or it can be more complex, this is the basis. So we're going to start out with individual characters and joining characters together in sequence. And then we'll introduce alternation. And then we're going to have iteration where we can repeat something so I can have a sequence of letters. So, for example, if I wanted to have an identifier, I could say A or B or C. And since I don't want to write down all 26 of them, let me use abbreviation kind of out of mathematics, where the three dots are ellipses. Turns out that in the form we use, the ellipses are slightly different. They're not dots, they're something else, but the notion is the same. So this says, give me a single letter, lowercase, from A through Z or Z. I can use parentheses, just like in ordinary mathematics, to group things. And I can use an exponentiation, in this case plus, that says one or more. And this is pretty close to an identifier definition. We have to include digits, but basically an identifier says it's any letter repeated once or twice or thrice or as many as you want. One of the cool things about this is, both in terms of our DEF and the implementation, is we don't try to put any limitation, like I talked about earlier, that it had to be 8 characters. Your underlying programming system might have that, hopefully not. But this says, how long is the identifier? As long as you care to make it. Now you say, that's silly, I could have an identifier that's 100 characters. And the answer is yes, you could. But notice that's not necessarily as crazy as it seems. If you ever had a piece of equipment and looked at the serial number, or something like on the base of, say, you happen to have a cable modem, they have something called a MAC address. Those things are monsters. I remember I was trying to work with Charter Cable, and my internet access was not working. So one of the things they wanted to know was my MAC address. Fortunately, I had photographed it, but the darn thing was on and on and on and on. And the reason was nobody said there was a limit, and you can make strings longer and longer, and you can imagine a string that contained your first name, your middle name, your last name, your student ID, and maybe your level of security or something. Are you allowed down to go down into the basement below Andromeda to the secret vault where all the gold bars are stored? What gold bars? Oh, you're not that level yet. Now, the secret place that has all the gold bars so that if you ever have to get out of the country soon, you just load up the plane or the helicopter, I guess, and away we go. So if you saw the evacuation of Saigon, now the evacuation of Verona or something to some safer place. So let's start developing this. And the notion will be then that we really want these things not just in their own right, although they're useful, just as a way of being able to have a formal notation that talks about the structure of a string. So you can imagine I might use a regular expression in a textbook. I'm not building a scanner, but the user or the person reading it wants to say, okay, I want to write a string. What exactly can I do and what I can't do? And we'll actually be going through some of those tokens and seeing that. So besides what we're using it for, they're actually available and useful in other contexts. So if you ever use a utility called grep, that's a Unix-level utility, but I believe DOS had a version 2. And do the new versions of Windows 7 and 10 still support DOS? Or some kind of command line language? Yeah, there's a special utility or something, isn't there, where you can go down the command line. So that still exists. I miss it when I don't have it in my various things. The Unix shells allow that, and this is something, it's always nice to have sort of an inside joke. So let me, it turns out in the old days, our secretarial staff were forced to use shared computers. The old day, people didn't have individual computers. They had terminals that tied into a networked computer, and they had to learn, God forbid, Unix. And I come by somebody and say, oh, my God, this is terrible. I'm never going to learn this. So I would tell them, there's a command that will solve all your problems. What you do is you type RM minus RF star. And I hear some groans. And those are people who know Unix. And this, but the point is, well, first we'll figure out what this is. But the star here is something that's exactly analogous to what we'll be developing in regular expression. Star means any character string of any length. So RM is not to, can anybody guess what that means? RM means remove. Minus sign is a way to have parameters associated with it. This little thing is not an I, it's an R. That means recursive. The F means forced. So if I were to type that and I had full permissions at a given point, what would it do? Wipe out everything. And particularly if you went to the root of your file system, you know, slash, you know, the ultimate root, it would wipe your whole system. Now, again, it wouldn't wipe it out to make it FBI-proof or anything like that. It would wipe it out in terms of files that used to be there weren't, and you better hope you get backups or something. But the notion is that this notion, which is used in tokens, actually exists in this context, and you don't want to do this. But there are a lot of other things at the command line, if you like to program at the command line, that use the notation of stars and other things, OR bars and so on, drawn from regular expressions. So that's sort of an inside joke, which the people who groaned knew what I was talking about. Other people said, what in the world was it? Fortunately, I had such low status that nobody ever obeyed what I suggested, so we never lost any file systems. Editors have that sort of thing. You can sometimes use a slash, a star to represent a run of characters. So you can say, find me, not A or B, but A star B, which would say anything begins with A and ends with B and has possibly something in between. And the Windows Find utility, which some of you, I think, may use, also allows some level of regular expressions. They always pick up the ones that are most useful. So we have regular expressions, and now we have this notion of regular sets. And the differentiation is a regular set is the actual string set that's being defined. The expression is the notation. So it's like saying, if I write down in mathematics the symbol pi. What is pi? It's a symbol, and it really represents some number, which in decimal format is 3.1415926535897, and that's about where I peter out. It turns out that something like 2 quadrillion digits of pi are currently known. Used to be whenever you get a bigger and better computer, one of the first things you do is have it compute more digits of pi. But 2 quadrillion is a lot of digits. And I think people explain it just because they want to have some fun and get paid for it. So We're going to talk about the sets that are actually defined, and those would actually be the tokens. So when we scan a token class, we'll say, I found a string that matches the pattern and hence belongs in this set. The set might be something simple like identifiers or integers, or it might be something more complex like quoted strings or quoted characters, which have a more defined structure. If you're reading, sometimes an instance of a token is called lexeme. I don't use it, but I've seen it. And in our case, whenever we see an instance that matches a token class, we'll simply call it a token, and particular a token of the particular variety. So again, token just means word in the programming language. So a token just simply says, I'm an identifier. I'm a reserved word if. I'm an integer literal. I'm a comma, a quoted string, a comment, and all the rest that we happen to have. Well, we have to have a vocabulary. And again, mathematicians love to use special symbols. So in textbooks, they're called sigma. It took me a long while to figure out how to get the sigma typed in there, but I got it. But in this case, typically, the character set will simply be the main character set the program will use. So we're going to use ASCII. ASCII has been around a long time. It's 128 characters, which means the last of the 8 bits is not used. It's 2 to the 7th is 128. But they contain the Roman alphabet and most of the special symbols, commas and braces and so on. But again, as I mentioned, don't feel like you're really being ultimately limited. If you have a bigger notation, particularly a language other than the Roman alphabet, you can use, in this case, Unicode characters, which again have a much, much wider range. And it turns out Unicode also has all kinds of special symbols that are not commonly found in ASCII because they're not frequently used enough. Little things like an arrow pointing up or an arrow pointing down or arrow pointing left or right and lots of these other little symbols. In fact, believe it or not, to show how things are changing, there's a proposal up to include in Unicode what? What would you think would be the least likely thing you'd imagine? Emojis, exactly right. So if you get all these emojis on there, and it turns out even the emojis are troublesome because I believe there was some problem. There are certain emojis were considered politically incorrect. They were suggestive of something that was naughty, and therefore they got pulled. So I guess there's something, do we have emojis, and who, you know, defines the list of acceptable emojis? And I don't know if you can change the color or anything like that. But it shows you any type of it. So now you can have a scanner that actually scans emojis. And you know, if you're one of these things like try to write some kind of something in emoji-only symbols, you know, you could go out and try to scan it, parse it, and figure out for old-timers like me. You know, somebody gave me this emoji string. What the hey does it mean? Oh, it means this in plain English. And you'd be a hero to guys like me for sure. We'll also have something that, again, you're a little unfamiliar with it or uncomfortable with it with strings, but it's called the empty string. Now, mathematically, we use lambda, but it turns out in many cases in programs, you use it in terms of a double quote followed immediately by a double quote. And in fact, I believe our string definition will say I can have an empty string, which says first double quote begins it, second double quote ends it, whatever is in between is the string, which may be nothing. So again, mathematically, we'll use lambda, but in many cases, we don't need lambda. We'll either have a literal form, or we'll have some operator which includes lambda when we want to include it. So as I was saying a minute ago, we're going to have ways of building regular expressions. And the cool thing about it is that these are very similar to what we see in programming languages. So what are the three basic operations in programming languages? The first one is sequential execution. Line 1, semicolon, line 2, etc. And you execute them in sequence. That's exactly like concatenation, where instead of executing a line, you match a character. The second one is alternation, A or B. But you do that all the time in if statements. If something, then part, or else part. And that's there. And the third basic operation in programming, and these are really the three you need to get anything non-trivial going, is some sort of iteration or looping, where you can say, keep running this loop until something happens. Well, I showed you the example of identifiers, where it says, keep reading lowercase letters until you can't anymore. Why? Well, you might hit a blank. You might hit a comma. You might hit the end of file. But at some point, you're going to run out of characters. We're assuming, of course, that all programs are finite. And that kind of makes sense because programming an infinite program might take a while. Certainly compiling would take a while. So in that particular case, it simply says, instead of looping until something goes false, you say keep looping and matching characters until I can't match anymore. And that, of course, follows one of the rules I promised you, namely, how do we determine the extent of an identifier? And the answer is, or any other token. And the answer is, you keep reading until you can't read anymore. And, of course, that follows exactly what you happen to want to do when you're reading an ordinary prose document. If you see the cat ate the kibble, well, is T a single word? No. T-H-E-R, a single word, and then you have a blank, and that says, hey, that's done with. And then you see some other characters and a terminator. And we're kind of used to doing that, but it turns out that these get more complex than you might imagine. And you see it in a very unexpected context, and that is namely in vanity plates. So you might see something like that. And maybe not. And in this particular case, the 8 is not the digit 8. But as you say, in those particular cases, you sometimes have to be able to figure out by pronunciations where the characters end and begin. So this is someone who doesn't like to go to Miller Park and see a lot of blue hats. In fact, there was a game a couple of weeks ago where some guy came out with this huge banner with a big blue L on it. And at the end of the game, these guys lost. And when you're in Chicago, they always print out a little flag with a W on it. And this thing was immense. It was 20, 30 feet across. And I still have a picture of it here. I'm going to save it for future use. So you might see something like that. But it gets even more complex. I was driving along around Hilldale, and I saw it was a Mercedes-Benz convertible, red one, of course. All good sports cars are red. And there's a very attractive woman driving it, and that was the vanity plate on her car. It took me a while to figure it out, and once I figured it out, I'm not sure I was right or wrong. Is going to anybody guess what my first guess was? Q-T-I. Q-T-I. So my first interpretation was Q-T was cutie, not with a Q but with a C, but whatever, and I means me. So somebody who's shown it off and not afraid to be a little boastful. But it turned out maybe I was wrong, because several weeks later, I was in that same area, and there's a company, which I didn't even know about, it may not even still be around, that ran temporaries, and it was called Quality Temporaries Incorporated, QTI. So to this day, I don't know whether this was the owner or the company or the manager or something, or it was totally unrelated. It was simply someone who had a Mercedes-Benz convertible, and most people don't. So I got it and you don't. Ha, ha, ha. And we'll figure out what it is. But this is a situation where even something as simple as figuring out where one word begins and another ends is non-trivial because you have a limited amount of space and all the games you're allowed to play. So in between this, which I probably wouldn't want for programming languages, and what we do have in programming languages, we have to have some sort of definitions that allow us to figure out where things end. In particular, it's not the case that we always use blanks to separate things, because you're certainly allowed, in this case, to say in a program, A plus B minus C times D. And that, even though there's no blanks at all in there, scans out to identifier, operator, identifier, operator, identifier, operator, identifier. A whole lot of tokens. And the reason it's able to do that is it sees an A and says, okay, it's going to have a run of letters or digits. Plus is neither. I have to end. Identifier can't go anything. I start plus. It turns out there's a plus and there's also a plus plus, which is in C and Java, and that means increment. But there's only one plus, so it's the operator, not the increment, and so on and so on and so on, all the way down. So this is not quite as bad as QTI or H8 Cubs. I won't say what I really think of it. So we want to have something that allows us to have a formal definition how to separate them without being too overly complex. So we're starting out with catenation, and That is, we'll take characters in the character set. Again, sigma is just the characters you have. ASCII characters, for example. And what will happen is we'll keep reading characters, and as we read characters, the length of the token will grow until the string we have can't possibly match any of our definitions. We can start out with lambda. Think of lambda as being the empty string, and just like zero, which is the null number, zero plus anything is anything, the lambda concatenated with a string is a string itself. So that says mathematically, building a string by first initializing it to the empty string and then reading characters as appropriate is quite correct, because you have that mathematical thing that says a lambda appended to either side of a string is just the string itself. And that's the same thing as saying zero plus a number either way is still that number. And zero doesn't mean anything. So if you're comfortable with that, you'll know what we're talking about. We can assign concatenation to a set of strings that is, I'll define something that represents one set and concatenate it with another. So if I had sets P and Q, and that kind of pitchfork on the side is the membership symbol. So if I have a string S1 in P and S2 in Q, then S1 immediately followed by S2 is in P and Q. Yes? Say it louder. Was that on the previous slide? Oh. Right. Oh, I'm sorry. They didn't print out properly, is what you're saying on... Oh, golly. Okay. Yeah, somebody, this would be a great thing. So now I understand what she's saying. I thought she was saying there's something wrong with this. She's simply saying the lambda uniformly came out as an empty box rather than the lambda symbol.
All mathematical characters like lambda.
Oh. Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
None of them, all of them are like.
Okay. Is that true if you're running on Macs as well as you're running? No. Macs is right. Yeah, okay, the get me again situation there. It's supposed to be the case that things like PowerPoint are totally platform independent. Run it on a Windows, run on a Mac, doesn't matter. But you're seeing it does. So if anybody, one gentleman had an idea about how to handle it, if he would post that to Piazza so other people can share it, if you happen to have that problem, might be able to do it. Otherwise, I may be able to go ahead and take it on mine and have this print out not in standard PowerPoint where you can read through it, but in PDF. And then, just go through there. That is doable. And in some cases, it's situations that people want to follow along. You don't get the excitement of having it appear line by line by line. But I think if I print it on PDF is pretty solid. And there they'll come out. So let me know if you need that, and I can simply go back to my master, create a PDF, and what I may do, in fact, I'll think about doing that starting of this lecture, is going back and producing two versions. One is the PowerPoint and the other is the PDF, and hopefully the PDF will look very much like that. Turns out mine occasionally comes out bad, too. We haven't gotten to it yet, but in some situations, what happens is I did it actually the other direction. I went this from PDF into... It turns out Acrobat will allow you to generate PowerPoint from PDF. And usually it comes out pretty cleanly. But in this particular case, I'm okay. But in other cases, not everybody is. So alternation is the OR that I talked about. And that's when I can have a sequence of strings and say you take this part or that part. And here's an example where if I want to start out saying don't want to write digits, all 10 of them. I want to be able to have some set name called D. So think of D as just being like a variable or a placeholder in mathematics. So you say, let something be the set of all positive numbers. In this case, let D be the set of all single digit numbers, or single character digits. And in this case, 0, 1, 2, 3, and so on represent themselves. The OR bar is an operator saying A or B or 0 or 1. And the parens are delimiters. There are certain characters that are used as operators or delimiters, and they have to be specially escaped, as I'll show you, if you want them not as their ordinary usage, like plus or star, but rather as the actual characters. And one way to do that is to be doing quoting. So in this case, the thing up top says, I have a set that contains, since I quoted it, the single left paren is a left paren, or a single right paren, or a semicolon, or a comma. I want to have those four characters. If I didn't put that in there, it would confuse the left paren or the right paren with the delimiters and just misread exactly what I was writing down. Alternation is applied very nicely to sets of strings. So if I have a set P and also a set Q, P or Q means take a string entirely from P or entirely from Q, your choice. And here's a great example of it. I might have LC for lowercase letters and UC for uppercase letters. And in a situation where I don't care if it's upper or lower, I simply say take something that's a lower or an upper, thusly getting all 52 possible characters in the Roman alphabet. So we had two. Now we're going to have closure. And this is historically called Kleene closure. Historically, it's interesting because Kleene is Stephen Kleene, and he was actually one of the founders of our computer science department. Now you're taking courses, so it's yours as well as mine. And he did this way, way back when he was doing pure mathematics. But it's actually a form of iteration. So notice I have P and I have a superscript star. That's just like having a number as a superscript, say P squared or P cubed. P star says, go ahead, in this case, remember that I said that star, when we were talking about shell notation, represented any sequence of characters, including zero. And in this case, it says you can take from whatever P represents zero characters, that's lambda, or one character, which is a single one, or two. They don't have to be the same character. They could be one character from P and then a different, and as many as you want. So if I went back and took LC or UC and put a star right above the end of it, that would say give me zero or more characters that happen to be, in this case, alphabetic characters. And we'll see we do something very similar to that in just a bit. Zero selections are allowed by lambda. If there are cases where you don't want lambda, there's another operator we'll get to that is similar to Kleene closure called positive closure, and that uses a plus sign. So star says zero or more, plus says one or more, and you can take your choice. And in fact, here it is. I didn't need to go back. Should have remembered I had it. So LC star is all identifiers composed of lowercase strings, lowercase letters, including the zero length string. And here's a nice mathematical definition if you want it. So N is zero, so lambda is allowed. So now we're going to go along and actually have some definitions. So this one is purely in there to keep the mathematicians happy. It says a set of absolutely no strings at all is legal. So I can say, I give you no definition, so it matches nothing. And that's the empty definition. So it's the empty regular set of strings. Lambda is very useful, and that says it's a string that contains zero characters. And again, it's very useful as an initial character when you're building up a string. It's also useful for options. I'll show you later that it turns out that integer literals, that is numbers, oftentimes are allowed to be prefixed by a plus sign or a minus sign, but they don't need either, so you put lambda in there. So the prefix is a plus sign or a minus sign or lambda, followed by an integer literal, which is one or more digits, 0 through 9. And that turns out to be a very concise and very readable definition. So string S is a regular expression denoting the characters themselves. So if I have a very simple string like ABC or NBC, I can simply write down the characters, and that'll be a pattern that matches only those characters. So it's a singleton match. I can also build up elementary symbols like lambda or A or B and combine them using catenation or alternation or Kleene closure, which is iteration. And that's how I build up more complex definitions. So each regular expression denotes a regular set, and there's a sequence. So if I wanted to write down, and when I wrote this particular slide, I was teaching in C. See how long ago that was. And the reserved words that they had there was auto and break and case. But all languages, including ours, including Java, have a series of reserved words. And I could write down reserved as this or that or that or that. We'll have to get to the situation of whether case makes a difference. I preached about that last time when we were talking about symbol tables and getting to our definitions. It really will make a difference. So we'll get some other operations beyond these that are simply there to make writing down regular expressions easier. Oop, that's a good place to stop. So let's take about a 15-minute break, and we'll pick it up then about 15:45.